I used to have so many men.
How this beguiling woman in her 50s,
she looked like a million bucks,
scams a bunch of famous athletes out of untold fortunes.
Nearly $10 million was all gone.
It's just unbelievable.
Hide your money in your old Richmond because she is on the prowl.
Listen to Queen of the Con, Season 5, The Athlete Whisperer on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Danielle Moody here, host of the Woke AF Daily podcast. We've been with iHeart for a year, and what a year it has been. As we head deeper into 2024 and yet another life-changing election cycle, Woke AF Daily is here to keep you sane and woke. Make Woke AF Daily your podcast destination for 2024 election news and analysis. Listen to Woke AF Daily Season 5 on the iHeart Radio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
It's like the police knew who he was before they got here.
From iHeart Podcasts.
The medical school dean at USC was leading a secret double life.
He's breathing right now?
Yes, he's absolutely breathing. I'm a doctor, actually.
A story about money, power, and corruption.
When people fall in line, they fall in line.
Looking back, I realized, everyone knew.
I'm Paul Pringle, an investigative reporter for the LA Times. Listen to Fallen Angels, a story of California corruption on the iHeart Radio app, Apple Podcast, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Danny Shapiro, and this is The Way We Live Now. Today is day 105, since talking to lots of tiny heads on our computer has started to feel almost normal, and day 51 of this podcast. You know, hosting this daily podcast is, well, it's a lot of work, and I already have a couple of full-time jobs. Sometimes I wonder if I should keep it up. And then I get to have a conversation like today's with yet another extraordinary human being, Harvard professor Arthur Kleinman, one of the most renowned and influential scholars and writers on psychiatry, anthropology, global health, and cultural and humanistic issues in medicine. Arthur, thank you so much for joining me to talk about The Way We Live Now.
A pleasure to be here.
So I started this podcast a couple of months ago because I sensed that within the COVID-induced isolation, many of us are longing for more connection, for windows into each other's lives. In that spirit, could you share with us where you are right now while we're having this conversation, and what are you surrounded by, and what are you looking at?
I'm in my house in Cambridge, and I'm looking out into the garden at the beautiful late spring, early summer flowers and big trees. And on one side of me is a filled bookshelf, and on the other side is a computer.
That sounds familiar. Your most recent book, which I just devoured and absolutely loved, is called The Soul of Care. And it chronicles, as the subtitle so aptly puts it, your moral education, both as a husband and as a doctor. And I was so struck reading it by a through line in the book, that of the profound benefits of being in the room, in the homes of your patients, as was true for you as a boy when your own pediatrician, Dr. Ben, would make home visits for you.
Right.
And I'm wondering, now that we're in this era, hopefully temporary, of telemedicine and of doctors being completely unable to touch patients, I wonder if you have any thoughts about that.
My view is that care is all about touch. It's about being there with your presence. It's about the quality of relationships. Actually, if you think about it, all the places, the hospitals, the nursing homes, the systems that claim that they have high quality care, none of them measure the quality of care. Because if you had to measure the quality of care, you'd have to measure the doctor-patient, nurse-patient relationship, the quality of communication, the whether a physician and a nurse is able to listen intensely and witness and respond and give answers that are clear and effective and follow up and show that they have presence, that they're just not going through the motions mechanically. All those things are central to what care is, and we don't measure any of them. And so that should give us an idea right away that the healthcare system is really not about care. It's about institutional efficiency, in which large organizations like hospitals substitute institutional efficiency, that is, how many patients move through a system at what rate with what kind of outcome, that substitutes for the quality of care. So I'm very interested in the quality of care and seeing it improve. And in my lifetime, I think I've seen greater constraint and hedging around the ability of doctors and nurses to give care. Look at the way today doctors are, as you put it, are all bundled up as their nurses in their protective gear, which they have to be, and in the hospital setting are hesitant, and indeed often there's a protocol suggesting they don't touch patients if it's unnecessary for fear of the COVID virus. In that setting, you still hope that the humanness of the experience will get through, but it's not so easy. And if you think about just the change in time since I was a beginning medical student in 1962, at that time, medicine was much more a practice of people being together and sorting out problems. And today, technology, which should, and I believe will ultimately, contribute to improved care, actually gets in the way of care. And my colleague Atul Gawande has written a lovely piece in The New Yorker about half a year ago, pointing out how frustrating the electronic medical record is for doctors. That's why their back is turned to patients. That's why they are constantly looking at the computer screen, because it's so difficult to use. It wasn't made for caregiving, but it could be. And so we have a situation in which there are many things working against good care. If you look at the data from medical schools, there's a surprising and dismaying finding, which is that graduating medical students are worse than incoming medical students on all the measures of care, from taking the history to being more human with patients. That's a terrible critique of what medical education is about. At the same time, it's loading doctors up with information about science and technology. It is destroying something that they already bring in, which is the quality of their interpersonal relations.
The implication in that is that somehow the capacity for or the ability to empathize or have compassion is reduced over those years out of just sheer pace and exhaustion and the institutional system?
Yes, exactly. So that there's something actively disabling in the training of doctors that moves them away from their ability to be human with others. Most of us are socialized to be effectively human in our relations with others. We know how to talk to people, we know how to empathize, we know how to have compassion, etc. And medical students show this, otherwise they wouldn't get into medical school. And yet something happens to them in the course of care. And I think that insidious and awful process is not just limited to medical school. It's found in hospitals and large clinics. It's in our healthcare system. And it is kind of an equivalent to what we're so concerned about today, which is institutionalized racism. This is a kind of an institutionalized anti-humanness that is found in many domains, and I think reflects a failure of centering ourselves on the values we've always taken to be central to medicine, which is the value of doing good in the world, of helping people, of being connected to others. And, in our society, we're such a radically libertarian society with the idea that the individual is the key to everything, and that the individual raised herself or himself up themselves. That's all nonsense. We're all inseparable from social networks, and those networks are critical in care. And so we learn things as we look carefully at care that are very surprising and very disturbing. For example, we discover a very good report on this by the National Academy of Medicine called Families Caring for an Aging America, we discover that surgeons and surgical nurses often don't effectively convey what the aftercare situation will be like for older patients getting surgery. And so when those older patients return home to their families, they may have drains coming out of their abdomen. And no one has told the family to be prepared for drains coming out of the abdomen. So the family is scared stiff, doesn't know what to do, is afraid that they'll infect the patient. And that is an example you could just cite 1,000 times. The failure in connecting, in worrying about, in caring for, that's all part of what caregiving should be about. And we have the paradox in America today of care, of caregiving in the absence of care. And I think that's what I wrote against. I wanted to see that changed and critiqued. And that's why The Soul of Care is a story not just about our system, but illustrated by my own personal experience. I was not destined to be a caring family carer and or a caregiver. I grew up in New York City and socialized in the 1940s and 50s and was a rough kid who was on his way probably to delinquency and had very few of the ideas and values about the importance of caring for myself and caring for others. And I learned that in the course of a wonderful marriage to my late wife, Joan, who we were married for 46 years. And for 36 of those years, she took care of me. And then I took care of her for 10 of the years as she battled with a horrible disease, early onset Alzheimer's disease.
That was the most moving part of your book, revolving around that decade. Well, two things. First, that you introduce us to Joan and we really get to know her. We get to know her as, you know, in the full flower of her humanness and her life. And then you write really deeply into the decade where you become her primary caregiver. Can you speak about some of what you learned during that time? You know, I also, you know, one of the reasons why I wanted to have you on this show is that I think that we are all in a moment of collective, really global suffering and isolation and trauma. And I know that you've written a bit about some of what you learned during that time, which was also tremendously isolating and where there was a lot that was traumatic and difficult going on.
Yeah, sure. I'm happy to respond to that. Chronic care, my expertise is in the area of chronic illness. Chronic care for people who have chronic diseases, who have neurodegenerative diseases, or are post-stroke, or have dementias like Alzheimer's disease, is a matter of how you endure, how you keep going through periods that get worse and worse. These are progressive diseases usually that get worse, sometimes they get better. If it's a disease like asthma or diabetes or hypertension, but for most of them, over time, as people age, these are getting worse, these disorders. And you've got to be with people. And in the area of dementia, they get worse in the worst of ways, where people not only lose their memory and sense of self, but become delirious, psychotic, incredibly difficult to care for. These are people like my wife, who are the most wonderful of personalities and the most supportive of people, became incredibly difficult to care for. How do you keep going? How do you keep going? And in a setting like that, I think an amazing number of family carers, friends, family, do keep going. And my concern is, how do they do that? And I think that is where care morally transforms us. We learn how to be human, how to be present, even in settings where it's very hard to be that way. We learn to do that by bringing ritual into our lives, by organizing habits that get us through the day, by learning how to be with people when they're in a terrible shape, and keep going, keep our hope up. Hope is no longer that things are going to be cured or that the future is going to end up with a positive outcome. No, the outcome is going to be the same as it would have been anyway. But how you handle it and how you deal with the person who you're caring for, that makes the world of difference. That's the difference between feeling that you've had a purposeful life in which you've done the things that were right to do and feeling really good about that, as opposed to feeling helpless and hopeless and lost, as it were, in the world. And so I'm very impressed by the scientific evidence, which shows that the family carers do have more psychological and physical problems because caring takes so much out of us, but also end up with more of a sense of a purposeful life, that they've done something of meaning, that they've been able to not just get through life with someone else, but do something that they felt was good and important and valued, et cetera. Well, I think all of that is about the way we live our values in our life. And I think you can, through caregiving, live a certain kind of value, which is very, very important. It was important to me, and it was crucial, it turned out, to my ability to keep going. And I think that's one of the most interesting things. We talk about in family carers or even professional carers, burnout, because there's a lot of burnout. But actually, it's not burnout that's so interesting. It's how do we keep going? How do we endure? And by endure, I don't mean that all the time it's a downer. It's terrible. We endure with moments of joy and happiness and good things happen, along with the fact that ultimately the outcome is not going to be so good. But the way that we keep going, that we help us to keep going, is something that you carry over into the rest of your life. And for me, my wife died in 2011. And for me, I carried over many of those things into the years subsequent to that, became more fully myself, I felt it, at any other time in my life. And a lot of the lessons I learned have actually been very helpful in self-isolation during the COVID-19 pandemic.
Yeah, that makes so much sense to me, because I think so many of the conversations I'm having with people are, I think people are finding that they are coming to know themselves, you know, that we are coming to know ourselves better in, or what we're made of. I always end these interviews with the question, what's bringing you hope, which I'm going to ask you in a minute. But I spoke a couple of weeks ago to Galen Gingrich, who's the senior minister at All Souls Unitarian Church in Manhattan. And when I asked Galen what was bringing him hope, he said, you know, I didn't know, I have all these practices and I have this spiritual life, but I didn't know who I would be really, you know, in the earthquake, in the burning building, in the extreme circumstance. We never know who we're going to be until we're there. And I think that was something I really felt in your book, and that you're describing now, was that sense of becoming the person in a deeper way that you hadn't known that you were or that you could be, even though you had spent your life caring for others.
Yeah, absolutely. And of course, there's no, you know, this is not like a movie. It's not like it ends and you've had a heroic end or something. You're really, in this story, there are no monsters and there are no heroes. This is about getting through life and being in life in such a way that you have a way of proceeding forward. And maybe this is the answer to your idea about what is hope, a way of proceeding forward in which you feel that you are yourself. You are who you are. And you've come to recognize that you've made yourself into something that is valuable and that lives your values. So, you know, we're accustomed in our society to have people talk about what their values are. But I think what you learn in caregiving is that values are not what you talk about. They're what you do. They are your daily doing. And I think that that's what taking care of yourself as much as taking care of anyone else is. It's your doing. It's your going through. It's your becoming. And I think that's constant and it doesn't end. I think that for a caregiver, it doesn't end with I can definitely assure you this, with the death of the person you're caring for, because it continues in the caring for memories. I spend a fair amount of time in the book on the idea of the caring for memories, because that's so much of your life after someone passes. And not just, by the way, a family member has the caring of memories. Physicians and nurses and social workers and other health providers know very well and remember quite well the stories they've gone through of caring for others, and they order those and rethink them and use them to supply their life with a fullness. And I think it's that fullness, that sense that yeah, you know, I feel that my presence, that it's there. I think that's the greatest gift to the caregiver, that you've been present and you know how to be present and you can be present for yourself. You know, I'm a psychiatrist as well as an anthropologist, and so many of us, in my experience, treat ourselves poorly. We have a way of treating others, and then when we deal with ourselves, we tend to be tougher or inattentive and the like. I think over time, you get to understand that your life has, even in the midst of the most difficult kind of care you could imagine, has a kind of beauty to it, a sort of moral fullness, a sense of moving in a direction that's good for you and good for others. And I think there's no, that is hope. That's the hope that keeps you moving. It's there to do, and you do it, and you keep doing it. And that's one of the things that impressed me the most, speaking with many family caregivers for patients with Alzheimer's disease, who I met, Joan and I met them along the course of her illness, that they'll tell you that they're up against the wall, they feel. The latest problem, someone who can't remember them or has a syndrome in which they think that they're an imposter or becomes terribly upset. It looks like it's a wall. You can't get over this. And then all of a sudden they find they can get over it. They can do the things that need to be done. And what enables that to happen? It's the love you have. It's the care you want to give that other person and that person's need for it. And also their expressed desire for it that carries you forward. So my own feeling is that caregiving is the most important thing in life, that it runs from caring about who you are and your world to giving care to others. And that when we are in this and overwhelmed by it and find it unendurable, we don't realize at the end that a gift is being given to us. The gift is that you're going to come out of this and you're going to have the sense of purpose and fulfillment. Now that may not make up for the terrible loss of someone you love, but it's a strong and abiding feeling that I think makes the rest of life, what's the right word? I'm not sure. I was going to say easier. It doesn't make the rest of life easier, but it makes the rest of life more filled with a sense of your accomplishing work on the self and on others that has made you more cultivated and better and has made others that way.
Mm. Arthur, that's really beautiful. Thank you so much for taking the time to talk about this with us today. I really appreciate it.
Well, my pleasure. And I hope your listeners will want to read The Soul of Care, because I put just about everything I have in me into it.
Thanks for listening to The Way We Live Now. Tell us the way you're living now. We want to hear. Call us on, you might want to get a pen for this, 909-713-8995. That's 909-713-8995. And record your story, and we might just use it on the pod. Also, you can join our Facebook group at facebook.com/groups/thewaywelivenowpod. We are creating a community here, and we would love for you to join us. You can find me on Instagram at Danny Ryder. The Way We Live Now is a production of iHeartRadio. It's produced by Lowell Berlanti. Bethann Macaluso is executive producer. Special thanks to Tristan McNeil and Tyler Klang. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Danielle Moody here, host of the Woke AF Daily podcast. We've been with iHeart for a year, and what a year it has been. As we head deeper into 2024 and yet another life-changing election cycle, Woke AF Daily is here to keep you sane and woke. Make Woke AF Daily your podcast destination for 2024 election news and analysis. Listen to Woke AF Daily Season 5 on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I used to have so many men.
How this beguiling woman in her 50s...
She looked like a million bucks.
...scams a bunch of famous athletes out of untold fortunes...
Nearly $10 million was all gone.
It's just unbelievable.
Hide your money in your old rich man, because she is on the prowl.
Listen to Queen of the Con, Season 5, The Athlete Whisperer, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
It's like the police knew who he was before they got here.
From iHeart Podcasts.
The medical school dean at USC was leading a secret double life.
He's breathing right now?
Yes, he's absolutely breathing. I'm a doctor, actually.
A story about money, power, and corruption.
When people fall in line, they fall in line.
Looking back, I realized, oh, everyone knew.
I'm Paul Pringle, an investigative reporter for the LA Times. Listen to Fallen Angels, a story of California corruption on the iHeart Radio app, Apple Podcast, or wherever you get your podcasts.